everyone. My name is Brian Quinn. I'm an attorney. I'm here today on behalf of Lawyers Concern for Lawyers of Pennsylvania to make a presentation to you entitled, No One Makes It Out Unscathed, The Effects of Personal Trauma and Stress on Our Lives. I am the Education and Outreach Coordinator for Lawyers Concern for Lawyers, which is the Lawyers Assistance Program here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Before I begin, I want to tell you that I may make reference from time to time to lawyers' assistance programs. I urge everyone who is viewing and listening to this presentation to be familiar with their own lawyers' assistance program in their state. Many states have independent programs like we do have here in Pennsylvania. Some are part of the State Bar Association. There's going to be a directory, a link to the directory of all 50 states' lawyers' assistance programs at the conclusion. So you may want to look at that. There's also some resource material referenced at the end of the slides that are prepared and provided to you as part of this presentation. So I'm going to start by discussing really the prevalence rates of impairment in the legal profession. I always like to try to put this stuff in perspective because, you know, to simply talk about personal trauma and stress on people's lives is one thing. When we deal with lawyers, we're already in a profession that has been profoundly impacted by all sorts of issues, problematic drinking, mental health disorders, substance use disorders. So that's why I want to start off by discussing those. About 5 or 6 years ago, the ABA decided to perform a study of these issues in the legal profession. So they teamed up with the Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation. They retained the services of a lawyer and a certified drug and alcohol counselor named Patrick Krill. Krill surveyed the responses of nearly 13,000 licensed attorneys throughout 19 states. The qualifications had to be A, licensed attorney, and B, employed in some capacity in the legal profession. They were anonymous and confidential questionnaires that were presented. So what Krill found were, in his own words, to be results that are incompatible with a sustainable professional culture. The first thing he found was that 21% of all licensed attorneys suffer from problematic drinking, which is defined as hazardous or possible dependent drinking. Not just having one or two too many once in a while, but something that qualified as hazardous or possible dependent drinking, with nearly a third of all lawyers under the age of 30 also being defined as problem drinkers. That compares with 11% of the highly educated adults in this country. And once again, this was published in February of 2016 in the Journal of Addiction Medicine. So I want to give you some statistics, and we're going to move them forward a little bit. He also studied the use of drugs in our profession. And interestingly enough, of the nearly 13,000 lawyers who engaged in the survey, only 3,400 answered the questions about drugs. Nearly 10,000 lawyers just skipped right over those questions. And it's not because, in Krill's opinion, that lawyers don't use drugs. It's simply because they don't want to talk about it. Alcohol is legal, not to mention socially acceptable, quite socially acceptable in many circles of our profession, but not so much with drugs, especially illegal drugs. But they certainly did want to speak about their mental health. And that's really the thrust of today's program, our mental health issues. So when he asked those questions, keep in mind this as well. Krill analyzed the questions and compared them with the criteria necessary for under the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual, DSM, criteria to see whether they qualified for clinical definitions of mental health disorders. And these are the numbers that he found. 28% of all attorneys suffer from depression, major depressive disorder. 23% of all attorneys suffer from stress disorder. 19% of all attorneys from anxiety disorder. once again in 2016, and higher rates among younger lawyers. Now, step that up a few years. As a matter of fact, until there was no other study done until late 2019, and it was performed by ALM Intelligence and Law.com. The survey was conducted in the last 2 months of 2019, and the findings were published in February of this year, February the 19th, 2020. Interestingly enough, it found that lawyers were more willing to discuss their mental health issues. However, we have to have this caveat. This study simply recorded how people felt, how they described their feelings about what they do as lawyers, and how the practice of law and the legal profession has impacted that. These were not necessarily compared to clinical findings necessary to qualify as depressive disorder, stress disorder, as I mentioned in the Krill report. So the factor, the main factor being that lawyers and people in general that aren't doctors can't really self-diagnose their mental health disorders. But you should also know that they have a tendency, especially lawyers, to underreport drug and alcohol use. So many will kind of lessen the impact of that. But when they express their feelings, this is what they said. First of all, an overwhelming majority of legal professionals believe that their mental well-being is worse off as a result of their chosen career, according to this survey that was recently done. It was found that 74% of the lawyers surveyed felt that the profession had had a negative impact on their mental health. 64% feel they suffer from anxiety. 31% feel they are depressed. 74%, once again, felt that their work environment, not just the profession, the legal profession, but that their work environment within that profession contributes negatively to their mental health well-being. 18% have contemplated suicide at some point in their careers. That number, when Krill saw this report just 2 months ago, was quoted as saying that the number was astounding, as it's nearly double the lifetime rate of suicidal ideation in the general population. So nearly a third of the respondents said they have increased their use of drugs or alcohol as a result of their work or work environment. 44% use alcohol to deal with stress. So those are rather staggering numbers, and they continue. When it comes to, when asked about what about their job negatively impacts their mental well-being, the respondents identified a number of factors. Most popular among those was the feeling of always being on call and unable to disconnect, billable hour pressures, and lack of sleep and client demands followed close behind. Only 36% of those surveyed use all their vacation time. 35% do not feel safe discussing their mental health at work. And more than a third felt that the billable hour has a major effect on stress level. And only 10% of those surveyed, 10% felt that the billable hour as a concept had had no effect, no impact on their mental health. So 62% know a colleague who's depressed. 50% know a colleague with an alcohol problem. Interesting statistics about whether or not lawyers feel safe doing something about their mental health, according to that survey. 65% thought they couldn't take an extended leave for their from their employment to tend to their mental health issues. Reasons? Well, nearly 80% felt that an extended leave would either hurt their career or were fearful of what the firm would think. But most interesting of all these statistics for me was that more than half felt they had too much work to do to take an extended leave. So it's their work that causes them their stress and their mental health issues. And yet they felt they had too much of it to take an extended leave to tend to their mental health. So it's like the never-ending hamster on the wheel approach. Some of the common warning signs in the law firm setting, I think bear mentioning as well. And this has to do with not only the impact of trauma, but of stress, stress-related warning signs. First and foremost, and it doesn't really matter what type of impairment it is, isolation and avoiding interactions is a major warning sign among lawyers. Keep in mind, this is not just people in general. We're talking about lawyers. Lawyers love to isolate. Lawyers do not like to discuss their problems. After all, we're problem solvers. We don't have problems. People come to us to solve their problems. If we do have them, we're certainly not going to talk about them. Mood swings, increased irritation, a lot of lateness and absenteeism, missing deadlines, lots of excuses for unexplained issues. You often find the lawyer who's impaired disappearing at unexpected times, depending on what's going on. Perhaps it's alcohol. Or perhaps they want to leave the office a little early to get a drink, or maybe not come back from lunch. Late extended breaks, extended lunches, looking at being tired all the time. Decreases in productivity certainly occur, and there's always a lot of somatic complaints, frequent somatic complaints among almost every type of impairment. Depression, stress, anxiety, substance use disorders. You see a lot of complaints, either being unable to sleep or sleeping too much. So these are some of the issues that we see happening in our profession, in the law firm setting. Interestingly enough, there is a connection between, I wasn't really going to talk too much about depression itself, except for the fact I want to mention that stressful life events are one of the causes of depression. There's many possible causes, first of all, of depression, but stressful life events and trauma are among them. So they do relate to depression, both stress and trauma. As I record this presentation, it is in the spring of 2020 during the COVID-19 pandemic. And I dare say that COVID-19 is being defined as at least a stressful life event. And in fact, as you will hear later when I discuss trauma in more detail, it is a probably a generational form of trauma. Once again, among those symptoms of depression is isolation. So they are interrelated. I mentioned isolation in the law firm setting as being right at the top of my list. Well, one of the symptoms of depression is social or occupational distress or isolation. So let's talk about stress itself, because that is one of the main topics of today's conversation and presentation. So what is it? Psychological stress is composed of the following sequence of elements: a stimulus, a thought, an emotion, and a behavior. Our mental response to stress reflects how we first perceive and then subsequently think about any given situation. Our brains are constantly evaluating our present circumstances and defining it as rewarding, risky, threatening, or unknown. So that initial response operates on a subconscious level, influences our emotional and physical responses, which are interrelated, by the way. This subconscious and spontaneous analysis of every situation we encounter is really a vital part of our instinctive survival mechanism. Think in terms of the animal kingdom's freeze, fight, or flight response. So our brains are sending out signals to the rest of our body, triggering specific chemical reactions as well as other specific physical and emotional responses. Sometimes this subconscious process propels us to take immediate action in an emergency to get out of harm's way, or it may trigger a fear-based response, causing us to strike out in defense and later regret our actions. We can, however, exert conscious control over our thoughts and our emotions to put the brakes, hit the pause button, put the brakes on impulsive, harmful, or inappropriate emotions and behavior. We really can and must consciously change our reactions if we are to reach our full potential in life. We can learn to hit that pause button, to thoughtfully respond rather than to instinctively react. So thoughtful, optimistic, and calm emotional responses reduce harmful stress. Resentment, anxiety, and anger generate harmful stress. Our individual responses may differ from one another because of our individual differences in genetic makeup, childhood experiences, and environment. Present circumstances, whether our health, what is our condition of our health, our financial situation, our personal relationship, whether we've had any previous similar experiences. Speaking of COVID, I don't think anybody's had a previous similar experience like this. Our awareness and our understanding of what's happening and what can be done, if anything, about the situation. What can be done and what can't be done. And of course, that will lead to a conversation I'm going to have in a few minutes about what happens inside of us when we think we can control things that we really can't. So in addition, our individual response to the same situation may also vary depending upon how we're feeling physically and emotionally at that time, at that very time. Some days we deal well with a particular stressor. Some days we deal poorly with the same exact stressor. So the many variables that influence our initial emotional response include, among other things, whether it's a first-time experience, COVID-19 thing, which, as I said, first-time experience, whether any prior similar experiences were positive or negative. If we made it out one, you know, and got through one situation, we are faced with the same stressor later, we may have a better chance. It's not necessarily going to happen that way. Sometimes, as I said, you deal with one way and you deal with it poorly, the exact same stressor on another occasion. It depends on how we're feeling. As I said, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, ill, injured, taking medicine, whether we're anxious or fearful about something else, whether we were caught off guard. Many of these happened quite suddenly. All these factors are going to affect how we perceive and react to our present circumstances. So, do you stay calm and unruffled, looking for solutions, or do you get angry, look for somebody to blame? Some people are stress hardy. They don't seem to be affected by the pressures and problems of daily living. They seem to thrive on the challenges put before them. I don't know anybody that's thriving under the pressures produced by the COVID-19 pandemic, but as I said, we're all different. Otherwise, we would all react in the same manner to a given situation. Some people can thrive, as I said, on challenges. Others are unable to withstand any pressure or difficulty without being upset or really rendered unable to act. Most of us fall in between somewhere, in between. So one of the questions I think we need to ask ourselves, let's look at, how stressed are you? How stressed are you? Does your work require you to do too much in too little time? Keep in mind, I tried to make this lawyer related. There's a lot of other things in our lives other than being a lawyer, but for the most part, you know, our life is our work is our life. That's one of the qualities of a lawyer. And sometimes we have to pay the consequences as a result of that. Your work requires you to do too much in too little time. Very common complaint. Now, here's the next one I laugh at sometimes, is I don't have enough time to spend with my family. Now I'm hearing, I've been with my family so much for the last several weeks that it's driving me crazy. But not being able to socialize, pursue recreational and social activities can be a form of a cause of stress. Competition can make it difficult for us. We start to feel that making a living as a lawyer due to competition is a stressful situation for us. Sometimes it's just a matter of working in a firm or a part of the firm, a department that lacks collegiality. In other words, the people are cold, unfriendly, or rude. Some people complain about mismanaged firms, and they get stressed over that. They don't think that they're being compensated well for what they're doing. We're focused on profit, the firm. Our firm is too focused on profit, and that creates a poor environment. Remember to go back to that survey. It was just published 2 months ago, in February of 2020. It's too the point is that whenever you hear this, it's a recent survey, that the physical environment is not only unpleasant, but it's a cause of mental health issues, distress, anxiety. Some people start to question whether they're good at what they do, that their work starts to bore them. They're not making a positive contribution to society or the lives of other people. They don't feel that they don't get enough respect for what they're doing. Or conversely, what they're doing doesn't even deserve respect. That's where the depression starts to set in. That's where depression can be an issue. Ah, yes. Then we've got one of the other stressors. I deal with too many unreasonable and difficult people. By the way, sometimes those folks are called clients. So that was one of the complaints and factors in that recent survey as well. Client demands, never being able to disconnect, always being on call. You know, when I went to law school, I graduated quite some time ago. I'm not going to mention the year. That's 1973. I'm not shy. I've been around a while. And they told me they were going to teach me how to think like a lawyer. Then they did. So what are some of the other things that stress lawyers out? We feel overly responsible for everything and everybody. We overanalyze things. We become too cautious. Sometimes we feel defeated or hopeless because we're in a win-lose profession. Sometimes we unfortunately rely on alcohol or drugs to help us feel good. I already mentioned those statistics. And often we think about quitting, and occasionally we contemplate suicidal ideation. So, too many events. Some stress, let's put it this way. Some stress is actually healthy. Positive stressors can really energize and motivate a lawyer and help us be productive, creative problem solvers, really. A totally stress-free life is not only unrealistic, it actually, we think, is a harmful form of denial. I have a standing offer to anyone who can tell me and explain to me that they've never had a stressful moment in their entire legal career. Even though 33% of those surveyed by Patrick Krill several years ago said just that. And I think, well, 67% said yes. They've either been depressed, stressed, or anxious at some point in their careers. And 33% that said that they hadn't. And I really question that. So as I said, too many events, changes, or demands in our lives, even positive ones, can leave us feeling overwhelmed, sometimes paralyzed with worry about how we'll get it all done. Yes, it can be positive, but sometimes we get to a point where life seems too much for us to handle. And at that point, stress ceases to be our ally, but now has become our foe. We have entered into a life of distress. We need to eliminate distress. Distress is harmful to us both physically and psychologically. Gradual, incremental increases in our responsibilities and before I say much more about it, this is a caveat, a warning to us. We can be in distress and not even know it. And the reason is it doesn't just happen at the snap of a finger. It can be gradual and incremental. Our responsibilities, our duties, our the pressures and demands at work and at home, combined with long work days and weeks, is risky. At some point, work may dominate our lives and keep us at a chronically high level of distress. And yet we are often unaware that we have lost balance in our lives. Work-life balance. Work-life, people like to say, as if it's one word, is work-life balance. Balance. For some people, and there one of the surveys indicates that many lawyers work 70 plus hours a week. There is such a thing as workaholism. Those people stuff their feelings. That is, as they experience life's eventual troubles and periods of painful or difficult times, like many of us are facing right now, they stay busy with work. They don't allow themselves the experience of feeling the pain or sorrow or stress, nor do they discuss their innermost feelings with anybody else. Then, when there's not as much work to do, or even in times of attempting to relax with no busy schedule in front of them, those feelings come back and cause them discomfort. Because their solution has always been to get busy. Okay, that makes it difficult. Think about the only 36% of the lawyers say they take all their vacation. Workaholic doesn't like to go on vacation because there's always got to be something else to do.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is BUG. B-U-G. All lowercase. BUG. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is BUG. B-U-G. All lowercase. BUG. Please take a moment and write this down.
Do. And eventually, relaxation can cause people to feel distress. There's all sorts of new issues going on with the pandemic and with the stay-at-home orders. I live in a state, Pennsylvania, where the practice of law is not a life-sustaining profession or business, and only recently can law offices open now after 6 or 7 weeks of being totally closed. They can open for very limited purposes, and that has to do with preparing wills, powers of attorney, advanced medical directives. But other than that, you know, courts are closed. So those kinds of things can cause a lot of people extra distress. No phone calls, no court equals no money. What am I going to do? So how do we deal with it? Well, some people surrender. They just give up. Passive acceptance of stressful situations as being beyond our control, accepting the negative consequences, despite the ability to do something about it. Now, that's a behavior that's driven by fear and hopelessness and really can result in anxiety and depressive disorders. Okay, very, very, very dangerous. Now, I want to give you a little quiz right now, okay? I'm going to call this a level of distress quiz. There's no slides for these. Just make a mental note or write down every time you think one of these apply to you. Do you sleep less than 7 or 8 hours per night? Is your sleep restless? Or you wake up a lot? Is it difficult to get out of bed in the morning? Do you exercise less than 5 hours a week, including walks? Do you eat a lot of fast foods or junk foods? Do you skip breakfast or lunch? Do you drink more than 2 to 3 cups of coffee a day? Do you drink more than 2 to 3 alcoholic beverages a day? Do you take sedatives or sleep aids with or without a drink to relax or sleep? Are you more impatient and irritable than you would like to be? Do you feel that you are not in control of your life? Are you feeling worn out at the end of most days? You wish for more time to spend with family or yourself. Are you worried about your marriage, children, parents? You're struggling to make financial ends meet? You work a lot of nights, weekends, or holidays? You skip vacations? Do you feel that you don't have anybody to confide in? Are you feeling stressed over how many yes answers you just gave? The more check marks, the greater the likelihood that you are in distress. Change is possible and help is available. So that's where the Lawyers Assistance Programs come into play. Many of you may work at firms where they have employee assistance programs, employee benefit programs that cover issues like this. Many lawyers, as the statistics have already shown us, don't want to talk about it, don't want to talk about it at work. They're afraid of how they'll be viewed in the work environment. That's why Lawyers Assistance Programs exist, as a safe, confidential source of help for lawyers and their families for the most part. I can't speak for every organization in the United States. That's why you will see some slides at the end of this program that will mention the fact that check your own state's program. There's a directory at the end of this. Keep in mind, confidential, 24-hour assistance for lawyers and their families. And now more than ever, we need to concentrate on helping lawyers' families as well. We're a lot of us are spending a lot more time with our family, but many of us are not. We're now more fearful. And as I said, the behavior driven by fear and hopelessness is the surrendering to stress, okay? We need to engage in some of these quick stress busters that I have mentioned on a couple of these slides. And some of them seem rather commonsensical. So pause, lean back, give your eyes a rest, take a few deep breaths. You know, there's meditation and mindfulness. You're going to hear a lot about that, much more than you probably have already. Use the cell phone that's always with you to find an app that maybe will help you with some mindfulness or some relaxation techniques. Try to maintain a sense of humor. Yes, if you can't leave the office when we all go back to work in our normal situation, whatever normal is going to be. And guess what? That's a source of anxiety and stress as well. But in the meantime, try to get a little exercise. Vary your routine. Don't get trapped in a rut. Try to prioritize your work and home and manage your time effectively. Successful time management reduces stress. Tried and true. Delegate. Ask for help. Write down whatever's going on. Write down your long-term and short-term project goals. Try to prepare a list of what has to be done and what you have to do to reach your goals. Make them realistic. You know, review, establish deadlines and priorities for each item, I don't care what it is, at home or at work. Really try to identify which items are both important and urgent. Try to maximize your time and efforts to accomplish those, with secondary emphasis on important but not urgent, okay? And whenever possible, when they're not important or not urgent, delegate wherever possible. Simple little tips for how to alleviate some of the stress related to with time management. Stress busters, yeah. Eat well, give your body fuel, not good fuel. One of the negative coping mechanisms that we've seen, and it was in that survey, but I didn't put it up on any of the slides, was an increase in eating unhealthy food. I already mentioned that 44% of the lawyers use a drink or a drug, mostly drink, to get from 60 to zero to reduce that stress that's going on. There were some that used some positive things like reading a book or getting a bit of extra sleep. Try to sleep 8 hours a night whenever possible, and try to not overuse alcohol or prescription drugs, because those are nothing more than quick fixes. They really are. The most difficult but have the best long-term results are, interestingly enough, engaging in a regular, healthy eating, exercise, and sleep regimen. Do something, actually do something about the hours. Maintain a realistic work-life balance. Create a cultural change in your work environment that's causing so many lawyers to think that it's a negative place and has a negative impact on their mental health. Try to establish a cultural change that values relationships. Very often overlooked, treating people in a civil, professional manner at all times, not just when it's to our benefit. I like to say that, you know, we're not going to all get along, especially in a work environment. And now that that's jumbled up with so many people, we're not all sole practitioners, but we're all solitary practitioners now, for many of us. I can't really speak for the whole country, but many lawyers are, for the time being. But regardless, when we get back to the to a full-scale normal working environment, treat people in a civil, professional manner. Act as if you care about them. It's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than it is to think your way into a new way of acting. So we'll create an environment that encourages the sharing and discussion of stressors. There's proven power of helping other people. There was a 30,000 person survey, a study done on the effect of stress over 10 years on the rate of death. Okay, it really does show that people who had more stress had a higher risk of death than those who did not. And a related study showed that the effect of stress on death rate was completely offset where people were regularly helping other people. So that transitions into the next phase of this conversation, which is about trauma. Trauma. What is it? Individual trauma results from an event, a series of events, or a set of circumstances experienced by an individual as physically or emotionally harmful or life-threatening, and then has long-lasting adverse effects on the individual's functioning and mental, physical, social, emotional, and spiritual well-being. That's from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, S-A-M-S-H-A. So that's what the clinical definition of trauma is. It does not need to involve actual physical harm to oneself. Okay? It can be witnessing the trauma, you know, learning about a loved one's trauma. It can be something like the COVID-19 crisis. Repeated exposure to actual traumatic events. Okay, keep in mind that for lawyers, this can happen at work. Repeated exposure to actual traumatic events or traumatized individuals. That's called vicarious trauma. Vicarious trauma. Okay, but it really needs to be addressed and processed emotionally, physically, cognitively, and spiritually. Otherwise, it will have a long-term impact on the survivor of a traumatic event. There's various types. I've updated these. As I said, I mentioned vicarious or secondary trauma distress, lawyers, first responders. There's childhood trauma, cultural and mass trauma. Think 9/11. Okay, COVID-19. Community, usually you think about school shootings, unfortunate events like that. Now think about COVID-19. Historical forms of trauma, generational and multi-generational, slavery, Holocaust. I hope that COVID-19 does not ultimately fit into that, but those are the intergenerational. Okay, types of traumas. Some of them are a little bit going to be marked by a more significant event. Some are the result of living a long period of time in a stressful environment. So complex is a little bit of both. When there's either a marked significant event in one's life, an accident, a death of a loved one, possibly even COVID-19 when it comes to that. Those are some of the types of trauma. It's really one of our most urgent public health issues, and really can affect people, all aspects of our lives throughout our lifetime. There's a history of trauma exposure, even in the absence of a traumatic stress reaction, PTSD, independently increases the risk of substance use disorder. Substance use meaning alcohol and or drugs. Okay. And I don't know what the exact percentage of trauma survivors are that develop PTSD, but I know one thing, that it can lead to engaging in high risk and or self injurious behaviors. They're really, and that's why we really emphasize what it really means to be trauma informed. I'm not a clinician, I'm a lawyer. I have some trauma in my life that I sometimes talk about. And if I get a chance, I'll explain to you how it really can impact you without even understanding what it is. We need to inform ourselves and our organizations, our system that we work in. It's trauma informative. It realizes the widespread impact of trauma. I think we all realize now a lot more about it now, instead of the daily. Well, we're still hearing daily death rates, okay, from COVID-19. I did find out recently that they're worried about children being exposed to all this on television, based on a study done in China, where 20% of the children are now exhibiting signs of depression, based upon the constant viewing of what's going on in that country with respect to the pandemic. But there is no question and some concern that exposure to this among our children can have long-lasting effects. It really will end up being a form of childhood trauma. Post-traumatic stress disorder is actually one of the most common co-occurring disorders with alcohol use. Okay, so when they examine the brains of people suffering from PTSD, I mentioned alcohol, also opioid use. The scans, brain scans of PTSD patients and opiate addicts look virtually the same. Okay, the physical and social pain is soothed by the opiates. So that's something that's being studied right now. There's no way of knowing what the long-term impact of the COVID-19 pandemic is going to be. But some of the psychological effects of trauma are depression, and there's already, keeping in mind that 28% of all lawyers under the Krill study suffered from clinical depression, attention deficit disorder, by the way, is a psychological effect of trauma, and 12.5% of all lawyers suffer from that. I didn't mention that one earlier. Anxiety. Remember that 61% of lawyers report feeling anxious and feeling that they have anxiety. That's certainly one of the psychological effects of trauma. I want to talk a little bit about anxiety. It's a feeling of worry, nervousness, or unease, typically about an imminent event or something with an uncertain outcome. We're in those times now. It's characterized by a variety of symptoms. Most important is the excessive and intrusive worrying that disrupts daily functioning. Some of the other symptoms are very similar to the ones I mentioned with respect to depression, agitation, irritability, restlessness, fatigue, once again, sleep disorders, difficulty concentrating, okay? But worry seems to be at the top. What is worry? Worry is a habit. Worry is a habit. It's nearly everyone worries occasionally, okay? It's a normal response to our problems and the unknown. A thought escalates into a story, our story, in which we play out this hypothetical scenario in our imagination. These thoughts are often in the form of a what if question. The words what if followed by the worst scenario your brain can imagine. There's really two types of worry. There's productive worry and there's unproductive worry. Productive worry is where we identify problems and use effective problem-solving strategies, as opposed to unproductive worry, which is worrying as a way of coping with problems we can't change. It adds worry and anxiety to an already unpleasant experience. One of the methods that we often discuss with respect to dealing with worry and anxiety produced by trauma is to practice mindfulness. And that really is a tried and true way of staying in the present, not letting that story get out of hand, that what if story. As I said, it's not usually a good story. It's a hypothetical bad outcome. What if I lose my job? What if I lose my home? What if I lose this? What if this happens? What if I get COVID-19? What if I then what? And then it goes on and on and on and on, and it gets away from us. So that's why mindfulness, staying in the present moment, keeping the what ifs under control, relinquishing our desire for certainty and control is easier said than done. I understand that, especially for lawyers. We have control issues, okay? But as long as we're going to focus on things that are out of our control, it's going to get us nowhere. So if you start to feel yourself spinning into negative, out into negativity or panic, you have to ground yourself in the present. It can stop that negative spiral. And that's what
Esquire CLE's second verification code is EAR. E-A-R. All lowercase. EAR. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is EAR. E-A-R. All lowercase. EAR. Please take a moment and write this down.
That's at the heart of this of post-traumatic stress disorder. It gets out of hand. Okay? It's a simple technique. It's effective. Brings your attention into the present. And lawyers, after all, we're in our own little world. We're not people who like to reach out. We like to, as I said, isolate some of the cognitive effects of trauma. We start to think this: when's the other shoe going to drop? The world's a bad place. We start to have avoidance, minimization, justification for our actions. That's where the denial starts to fit into play. Low distress tolerance. That means we get angry. Behavioral effects of trauma. Once again, they become almost a carbon copy of some of the other issues that we're discussing. The use of substances to make the feelings go away, to cope. We don't take the time to cope, develop positive coping skills. It's always negative coping skills. Okay, that's one of the biggest problems. But vicarious trauma in lawyers and judges is when we start to see what happens when, depending on the type of practice we have. Okay, there's going to be more of it in some areas than others. Not all types of practice of law have it kind of as our part of our everyday routine, where we're starting to hear about gruesome stories, criminal defense lawyers, prosecutors as well, judges who hear those cases, people who are engaged in child custody, children and youth services, child welfare cases, or even domestic relations in general, get this every day. That's where the vicarious trauma can come into play. But we start to avoid certain clients. We don't return certain phone calls. We don't even like to ask certain questions in client interviews because we just can't hear about one more unfortunate situation. We can have extreme physical reactions to trauma reminders. But mostly it's a change in our view of the world and other as being an unsafe place. And that's what people are worried about. and the studies can't possibly have any empirical data yet about what the impact of the pandemic is going to be on the people, on people's view of the world, as whether it's a safe or unsafe place. It's of great concern to psychologists and the medical profession right now, is how this is going to view society's view of the world, literally in a literal sense of the world. It can start to affect us physically. Headaches, extreme fatigue, stomach aches. We begin to withdraw from social interaction. It affects our parenting. We become more irritable, argumentative, impatient. We have a problem with focusing and remembering and concentrating. Those are also characteristics of someone suffering from stress, depression, or anxiety. So all these things really start to interplay and interact with each other. So lawyers with unprocessed trauma can actually transfer their trauma reactions and symptoms to their own clients. Re-traumatization of the client starts to happen. It impairs our attorney-client relationship and our effectiveness as lawyers. Sometimes we call it, in addition to secondary traumatic stress, compassion fatigue. That's another word for that. We become involved with engaged in a distorted view of ourselves. Okay, and as I said, it's especially in family law and criminal defense attorneys and judges in specialty courts, and those on the bench for greater than six years. And the most important thing is, you need to remember, is that it will affect you. I can't stress that enough. It will affect you. It's normal to be affected by your work and traumatic events. It's normal to have an impact like this when we're dealing with COVID-19. It's not that unusual. It's okay. It's okay. I can't stress that enough. Recognizing that is the most important coping skill you can give to yourself. It's that it's okay to feel horrified, shocked, saddened by what's going on sometimes in our lives. But if you feel overwhelmed, you need to seek help. Be aware of what's going on. You know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is resilience when it comes to these issues. You know, a lot of things have been canceled right now. One of them is not resilience. Resiliency. Life may not come with a map, but everyone will experience twists and turns from everyday challenges to traumatic events with more lasting impact, like the death of a loved one, a life-altering accident, a serious illness, or what we're seeing right now with the pandemic. Each change affects people differently, bringing a unique flood of thoughts, emotions, strong emotions for that matter, and uncertainty. People generally adapt well over time to life-changing stressful situations, in part thanks to resilience. Psychologists define resilience as the process of adapting well in the face of adversity, trauma, tragedy, threats, or significant sources of stress, such as family and relationship problems, as I said, health problems, workplace issues, financial stressors. We've talked about those. As much as resilience involves bouncing back from these difficult experiences, it can also involve profound personal growth. It's called post-traumatic growth. Post-traumatic growth. These adverse events don't have to determine the outcome of your life. There are many aspects of your life you can control, modify, and grow with. That's the role of resilience. Becoming more resilient not only helps you get through those difficult circumstances, it empowers you to grow and even improve your life along the way. Post-traumatic growth, adversarial growth. It refers to when the process of coping with adversity leads to higher levels of psychological functioning and well-being than previously experienced. The glass is half full, in other words. Look at it that way. This concept includes several dimensions. It enhances our relationships with relatives. It changes our view of ourselves and the world. or life philosophy. Being confronted with traumatic events may elicit a reevaluation of our life goals and priorities, such that we then emerge with a greater investment in and appreciation of life, interpersonal relationships, spirituality, and personal resources. Being resilient doesn't mean that a person won't experience difficulty or distress. In fact, the road to resilience is likely to involve considerable emotional distress. So while certain factors may make some individuals more resilient than others, it's not necessarily a trait that only some people possess. On the contrary, resilience involves behaviors, thoughts, and actions that anyone can learn and develop. So it's the ability to learn resilience. It's one of the reasons why we feel that it's not that it's ordinary, not extraordinary. That's what happened to us in 9/11, and we're hoping that that's what happens to us with the COVID-19 as well. So we can rebuild our lives after whatever it is that has impacted us. It increases our resilience. It takes time, though. It takes intentionality. You have to focus on four core components: connection, wellness, healthy thinking, and meaning. And it can empower us to withstand and learn from difficult and traumatic experiences like the ones we now face, not only as a profession, but as a people. As we've discussed, let me just talk about addiction and mental illness. These are diseases of isolation, separation, and disconnection. So we need to build our connections, prioritize our relationships. Connecting can remind us that we're not alone in the midst of difficulties. The pain of traumatic events can lead some people to isolate themselves. And lawyers, that's our go-to to begin with. It's important to accept help and support from those who care about you. Foster wellness by taking care of your body. Self-care may be a popular buzzword, but it's also a legitimate practice for mental health and building resilience. That's because stress is just as much physical as it is emotional. We need to promote positive lifestyle factors, proper nutrition, ample sleep, regular exercise, give our body fuel. We can strengthen our bodies to adapt to stress and reduce the toll of emotions like anxiety or depression. Practice mindfulness. Avoid negative outlets. Yes, it's very difficult. Disconnect. I say connect with people. Disconnect from devices. Okay, when you start to feel overwhelmed by social media, overwhelmed by what you see on TV, turn it off. Put them away. Put them away. Use them for positive reasons. And when they become just the opposite, turn them off. As I said, avoid negative outlets. You know, and the other type of negative outlet to avoid is alcohol and drugs, because it masks our pain. You know, focus on giving your body resources to manage stress rather than seeking to eliminate the feeling of stress altogether. Cope with it. Don't try to make it go away. Hide it, mask it, numb out. Find purpose, help others, be proactive. It's helpful to acknowledge and accept your emotions during hard times. As I said, it's okay. Just keep thinking of those words. It's okay to feel this way. Acknowledge and accept your emotions during hard times. It's also important to help foster self-discovery by asking yourself, what can I do about a problem in my life? If the problems seem too big to tackle, break them down into manageable pieces. Move towards your goals, realistic goals, even if it seems like a small accomplishment. It'll enable you to move toward the things you want to accomplish instead of focusing on tasks that seem unachievable. Ask yourself, what's the one thing I know I can accomplish today? Today. People often find they have grown in some respect as a result of a struggle. I hope that you're among those people. Embrace healthy thoughts. Keep things in perspective. maintain a hopeful outlook, because lawyers by nature have a problem with that. Benjamin Cardozo once wrote that happiness may not exist in a successful lawyer's life. And many people think it's the stress that starts in law school. It's heightened upon our graduation by our realization that the qualities we possess that made us good students are not necessarily those that will make us good lawyers. But more importantly, that the qualities that make for a good lawyer may not make for a happy human being. I said they told me they were going to teach me how to think like a lawyer, and then they did. We need to create a new environment, a new culture in our profession. Okay, we can't just stand by and let things happen. If you know someone struggling, reach out to them. Lawyers assistance programs throughout the United States serve just that purpose. Lawyers like to engage in denial. We're ashamed. We're embarrassed. What are people going to think? These are progressive illnesses. Each and every one of the ones that I spoke about today are progressive in nature. They will not go away by themselves. Therefore, we must do something about them. We must ask for help. 24/7, 365. Confidential, safe environment, like your lawyer's assistance program in your state. Check the rules of professional conduct. You'll probably find that there is no duty to report misconduct if someone goes to a lawyer's assistance program for help. That's at the crux of professional ethical conduct, is not to punish people for asking for help. Okay? Not to punish. We are lawyers. Lawyers impact all aspects of society every single day of our lives. Just imagine the impact that an impaired lawyer is having on society every single day. It's up to us as lawyers to ask the kinds of questions that may change people's lives, but it's up to us as lawyers to pick up the phone, make the call that may save someone's life. Thank you so much for allowing me to present this to you today. Have a great day.